Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Saints go marching in. The Saints win convincingly in the Super Bowl, and New Orleans takes a big step toward convincing the rest of the world that Katrina is off the field. The party is just beginning in the French Quarter. New Orleans spreads some well-earned bliss.
Oh, yes, I want to be in that number, yes.
On The Takeaway.
When the Saints go marching in.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, February 8th, and The Takeaway really, quite literally, is the party is just beginning in the city of the Big Easy.
And we'll continue probably all week long. We're joined now by Lola's Eric Eli. He joins us from New Orleans, where the Saints, of course, just won the Super Bowl. Lolas, that probably sounds relatively familiar to you. What does your city look like today?
Well, I tell you, I have barely gotten out of bed so far, but it was like that all night long last night.
And continuing this morning? People have not gone to bed, I assume.
Well, I tell you, we believe in party until there's no more party and that can be done.
And do you imagine? I don't know if when there is no more partying that can be done, Lolas.
Well, this has been such an incredible victory for us. The team didn't leave anything on the field, and we're not going to leave anything in the French Quarter.
Lola's Eric Eli is a former reporter for the Times-Picayune, joined us from New Orleans. We're going to talk more with him in just a moment.
We're going to explore some of the deeper themes of that Super Bowl victory by the New Orleans Saints overnight. In other news, Space Shuttle Endeavour blasted off this morning for the International Space Station.
Five, we have go ready to start. Two, one. Booster ignition and liftoff of Shuttle Endeavour.
The shuttle, with six on board, is carrying a dome-shaped observation deck that will, for the first time, give astronauts a panoramic view of space. Only four more shuttle flights are planned in the entire program after this one.
And in Middletown, Connecticut, the cleanup continues after a major blast at a power station yesterday. The plant was under construction. Investigators say five people died. It's still unclear if anyone else is buried under the rubble. The cause of the blast is being checked out, but terrorism has been ruled out. And despite the lowest unemployment figures in the nation, North Dakota has a growing homeless problem. Latest research shows desperate job seekers have flowed into the state looking for work. Some have found it. Many have not. In politics, Senator Charles Schumer says the message voters sent with Republican Scott Brown's upset victory in Massachusetts is clear. The focus should be on jobs. Senate Democrats are looking to push through a jobs bill this week. The Dow is going to start out this morning at 10,012. The S&P will open at 1,066, and the NASDAQ starts at 2,141. So we're going to be talking more about the Super Bowl in just a moment, but we're wondering, what's your takeaway from last night's Super Bowl?
My takeaway for the Super Bowl was the E-Trade commercials. That baby finally has new friends. He's traveling. He's even involved in a love triangle. He just gets more interesting every year.
As a friend of the show, Delana Dixon, what other takes do you have?
This is Patrick Henry Bass, and my takeaway from the Super Bowl was a great game, lame commercials with the exception of Hockenberry's very favorite comedian, Jay Leno, with Oprah and David Letterman.
I actually heard, that's Patrick Henry Bass, our friend of the show and contributor from Essence Magazine, but, you know, I actually heard that it was so hush-hush, the filming of that commercial with David Letterman and Oprah, and that Jay Leno showed up in a trench coat with a fake mustache in order to film it.
Well, indeed. If you have a takeaway from the game last night, 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org, we're going to be looking at the longer arcs of history, really, in that victory. Sure, it was just a football game, but it was a lot of sort of vindication and redemption for the people of New Orleans who've struggled so mightily since Hurricane Katrina. We're going to talk about that in just a moment.
Good morning. It's party time in New Orleans.
Of the goal line. The points are
wow.
Last night's Super Bowl victory, 31-17 of the Saints over the Indianapolis Colts. It was a victory for the football team, but it was also a victory for the city of New Orleans 4 years after Hurricane Katrina. As the sun was rising there this morning, we spoke with Jim Spalding, manager of the Avenue Bar, and he drew a direct line between last night's Super Bowl victory and Katrina.
Katrina could have been the greatest catastrophe to ever happen. This is probably the greatest uncatastrophe.
Jim Spalding clearly suffering after a long night of uncatastrophe-ing.
Yeah.
This uncatastrophe comes 2 days after New Orleans elected a new mayor, Mitch Landrieu. He's the first white mayor of the city in 32 years.
We decided that we were going to stick the pole in the ground and strike a blow for unity. Strike a blow for a city that decided to be unified rather than divided.
So lots of things going on in New Orleans. Could this be a turning point for the city? We are joined now again by Lola's Eric Eli. He's the former reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, now a writer for the upcoming show Tremé, scheduled to premiere on HBO in April. And Kenneth Purcell joins us again, an entrepreneur and CEO of iSeats, a travel and technology company in New Orleans. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Have you both been to bed?
I have, but it was a great night, even though I did get to sleep around 2.
2 in the morning, that's still a short period of sleep. So let me start with you, Lolas. We're not too far away from Mardi Gras. I would imagine that this is expected to be a big week for New Orleans. People might be taking the entire week off.
Well, I tell you, Carnival season goes for a couple of weeks, so we're already in carnival season, though it's not Mardi Gras day. And everywhere you go, all people have been talking about for the past 2 weeks is the Super Bowl. So work may be getting done, but it's certainly a bit distracted.
Well, I got to ask you, is this the first time, somebody said this morning that I saw in an interview, that this is the first time New Orleans has kind of recaptured that true celebratory mood that the city is famous for. Do you feel kind of a refreshed sense of victory and celebration there?
I can't say it's the first time, because the truth is, even in the 6 to 12 months after the storm, people were having parades as a means of reaffirming our culture and our celebration of being alive and seeing old friends. But the kind of unity behind this celebration is unprecedented in my lifetime.
Kenneth, let's talk to you real quickly. You're a CEO of iSeats, a company there in New Orleans. What kind of development might New Orleans see based on the Super Bowl victory, or maybe none at all?
Well, I walked down the street last night from my house at about, I guess, 9 o'clock. As soon as the game was over, as soon as they were handing the trophy over, and we're about 8 blocks from the foot of Bourbon Street, and so we walked down to Bourbon Street last night, and the positive energy in the air was electric. People were, you know, it was thousands and thousands of cars in just the 8 blocks walking to Bourbon Street, and tens of thousands of people. It was a celebratory mood, but it was unlike anything that I've ever seen, and I'm born and raised here. So it was a happy Gras as opposed to a Mardi Gras.
You know, there certainly is a lot.
It was unbelievable.
There's certainly a lot going on in your city right now. You know, Sean Payton last night, Lolas, and I wonder if you heard this, suggested that the trophy actually be broken up into a million little pieces to give to all the people in New Orleans and all the people scattered by Katrina who are New Orleans expat residents all over the country and the world. I thought that was a very profound point. What did you make of it?
Well, I thought, as you did about it, that both Sean Payton and Drew Brees were very clear about the significance of what they did for the entire city. And I thought they showed a great deal of class and compassion in doing that.
Well, Kenneth...
Yeah, absolutely.
Kenneth, let me ask you about, you know, some of the other news coming out of New Orleans, and that's the election of Mitch Landrieu, the first white mayor in more than 3 decades. Is that also a sign of a turning tide in New Orleans?
Well, I think that regardless of the mayor's the color, which, you know, obviously there's some historical significance to Mitch being Caucasian, but with the fact that we have a new mayor after Katrina, I think is reason enough to celebrate. Mitch just happened to be, from my perspective, certainly well head and shoulders above, and I think the city of New Orleans voted resoundingly yes, we're ready to change. And you know, it was just it was that alone was so positive, and is going to, you know, potentially change the face for the city for the next 4 years. And the Super Bowl is a great celebration, and it's unbelievable, and we feel like, you know, this has never happened before. But I think that alone, the new mayor is ultimately is more significant than what we feel right now about the Saints and the Super Bowl. So I think the real change is going to come from the mayor's office. But the real emotion right now is, you know, things are going well for the city of New Orleans.
Lolas, in most cities, I guess statistically, they show that a Super Bowl win is relatively short-lived. But in cities that have been devastated, and, you know, I was recently just came to New York from Detroit, anything that's a morale booster for a city can actually have a huge change in terms of what happens in the months ahead. And I'm wondering how you feel about that. Do you think that this kind of boost for the city's attitude and morale could actually change people's working attitudes?
Well, I have never lived in another city when it won a Super Bowl. So I keep trying to compare what's happened here with what happens in other cities. My impression, though, and from talking to friends, is that the way in which we've celebrated this and the way in which it's been taken to heart throughout the city is different from everywhere else. And let me give an example that will resonate with you from being from Detroit. The Times-Picayune reprinted the Monday paper after the Saints won the national championship, were headed to the Super Bowl, the national NFC championship, and they reprinted it again and reprinted it again. And in an era when newspapers are dying, you get that kind of enthusiasm, that kind of just wanting to be a part of it and wanting to have that as a keepsake.
Let's Lolas, Eric Eli, former reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, now a writer for the upcoming show Tremé, which is scheduled to premiere on HBO in April. Kenneth Purcell is an entrepreneur. He's CEO of iSeats, a travel and technology company in New Orleans. Congratulations to both of you. You can now say they are the national champs, Lolas. The Saints beat the Indianapolis Colts 31-17 in the Super Bowl last night.
And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's take a look at some of the headlines. This morning saw the pre-dawn launch of the space shuttle Endeavour. It's now rocketing towards the International Space Station, carrying a brand new observation deck that will allow astronauts a panoramic view of space. If you wondered what the link is between this story and another big story this morning, the Super Bowl, members of the International Space Station were remarking on some of the gear that's being taken up to the International Space Station was actually built in New Orleans. In other news, most trains, planes, and buses in Washington, D.C. are still frozen in place as the cleanup continues after the Mid-Atlantic blizzard. The nation's capital is pretty well shut down again today, with schools and even parts of the government closed for the day.
President Obama said Sunday he'll convene a half-day bipartisan health care session at the White House to be televised live this month to try and break the political impasse over health care. And staying with politics, Senate Democrats are looking to push through a jobs bill this week. The final measure will likely include some tax cuts to win GOP support. And abroad, unmanned surveillance planes may soon be flying under Iran's insignia. Iran State TV says the country has launched two production lines of unmanned aircraft or drones. Iran said a year ago it's built an unmanned surveillance aircraft with a range of more than 600 miles. That's long enough to reach Israel. And that's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. More about the Super Bowl win last night for the Saints in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
And our first news takeout takes you directly to last night's Super Bowl. It was supposed to be a high-scoring aerial contest. It wasn't, but it was a great game of pitting two fantastic offenses. And as our sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen predicted last week, it was all about the turnovers.
Hit off. Look out. Gets past Manning, and it's Tracy Porter taking it all the way. Touchdown, New Orleans.
That may have just locked it up. That Tracy Porter interception, one interception of the game, paid Peyton Manning through it, and in the end, it was all New Orleans Saints. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, you kind of called this one.
Yeah.
Recap the game for us.
It was a tough one.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, Indianapolis got off to a 10-point lead, yeah. And at that point, I would say it felt as though Indianapolis was charging ahead for their second Super Bowl. there was a fourth down stand that they had again when they stopped the Saints, and it was 10-3 at the time. Indiana held them, and at that point, the Colts had all the momentum in the game. Then we get into the second quarter, and it started to shift a little bit. New Orleans started to gain a little ground. They started to get a little momentum. They scored. They built some confidence, and then the Colts punted twice. They barely got on the field, and that's when I think Peyton Manning, the quarterback for the Colts, got a little iced. He got a little cold. He got a little stiff, and there was a little worry on the Colts side because the momentum was building. Come into the second half, and that's when things really started to change, because Sean Payton, the coach for the New Orleans Saints, made a daring call the first time that an onside kick was done not in the fourth quarter.
Well, nobody was expecting this.
Onside kick to start the second half. Is off the hands of a Colt, and it looks like the Saints had it for a second. And the Saints football, they recover the onside kick.
Hugely risky move, and it pays off, and it really put the Colts off guard, it seemed like.
It put them off guard, and then the Saints took advantage of it. I think it would have been one thing if they had done that and then the Colts had stopped them. If the Colts had stopped them, it would have changed the character of the game. But the Saints took that opportunity and drove quickly and scored a touchdown, and that really completely shifted the entire energy of the game. And coming to the fourth quarter, that was really the most – that was disaster. Everything crumbled for the Colts. They missed a field goal, and – of course,
it's a 51-yarder, though.
It was Matt Stover. He hadn't hit a 50-yarder since his first year, in 1993. And then, of course, the Tracy Porter interception. Let me go back to this one. Peyton Manning was throwing his bread and butter play, and the wide receiver was cutting to the left a little bit. And he was going to curl around to the right, and he was going to throw it to the right. Well, the Tracy Porter read the play from the beginning. He knew exactly what Peyton Manning was going to throw. Peyton Manning would tell you that it was an amazing play, but really, and that some people would say he made a mistake, but really, everyone was doing what they were supposed to do. But Tracy Porter knew exactly where he was going to throw it. He stopped them, and he's going to go into Saints lore for the rest of his life.
Yes, indeed. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen talking about the Super Bowl. The Saints win 31-17.
And in Connecticut, an explosion blew apart a power plant under construction in a town called Middleton. At least 5 people are dead. They're still searching for other casualties. Lucy Nalpathanchil now joins us. She's a reporter and producer at WNPR in Connecticut. Good morning, Lucy.
Good morning, Celeste.
What is the latest on casualties in Middletown?
Well, here's what we know. As of last night at a briefing, there are 5 confirmed dead, up to 14 injured. When this accident first happened, there were discussions that up to 100 people could have been on site. We now know there were about 50 construction workers on site at this power plant in Middletown, Connecticut, doing some routine work when this explosion happened. So right now it's really a search and rescue situation. There are search dogs on the scene. Emergency responders from around the state have descended upon Middletown, helping to try to find more bodies, possibly survivors of these workers that were on site when that explosion happened yesterday morning.
Well, the plant was under construction. We've heard already that authorities have said it is not terrorism. Do we have any idea what the cause was?
A lot of the officials, fire officials, say that they were doing a procedure known as a blowdown, where they're purging in these pipelines of natural gas when the explosion happened. And again, this explosion was so powerful that it could be felt about 20 miles away. It pretty much ricocheted down what's known as the Connecticut Valley region, because this plant is right by the Connecticut River. So it was a very scary moment for residents in town as well as around the state, because people didn't know what was happening. And again, we're finding out that it's been contained to this site in Middletown. These construction crew on site, there might be many people buried under metal, the rubble. Right now, they don't have a number of how many people they're looking for.
Okay, Lucy Nalpathanchil, she's a reporter and producer at WNPR.
Todd Zwillick, our Washington takeaway correspondent, joins us now with a portrait of Obama-style bipartisanship after the Democrats are licking their wounds from the results of that Massachusetts election and losing the 60-vote majority there in the Senate. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, John.
What's bipartisanship sound like? You have a little example.
Yeah, well, the president went on CBS television right before the Super Bowl. CBS carried the Super Bowl. He knew people would be watching, gave Katie Couric an interview, and invited Republicans to the table. Listen to this one, to talk about health care.
How do you guys want to lower costs? How do you guys intend to reform the insurance market so people with pre-existing conditions, for example, can get health care? How do you want to make sure that the 30 million people who don't have health insurance can get it?
Of course, he's talking to the American people more than Republicans, who he can actually pick up the phone and talk to right there in Washington.
Right, he is. And what you're seeing, I think, is a continuation of a shift in strategy from the White House. Of course, we all know they lost in Massachusetts. One of the messages the Democrats say they got from that race is more transparency, bring the GOP, more cooperation in Washington. Well, what the president is doing with this is saying, well, you know, Republicans, you've been doing your traditional role of sniping from the wings, criticizing. It's been working very well. Tell you what. February 25th, come on television in this meeting. Let's hear your healthcare ideas. You know, Democrats, one advantage they do have is their healthcare ideas have always polled much more popular with the public right. than Republicans. So, hey, let's hear your ideas. Let's let the public decide. And instead
bully,
of just shooting us from the wings.
Bully
you know?
Pulpit management there from the White House. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up after the Tea Party's convention last week, do they vanish without a trace or do they actually set an agenda of any kind? We're going to look at that with Marcus Mabry of The New York Times and the BBC's Rob Watson, and also talk about a major NATO offensive in Afghanistan coming up this week. But right now, let's check on the top news stories at coming up on 31 minutes after the hour. Last night, this was the call that kick-started the party in New Orleans.
Manning pumps right, looks left, throws over the middle, and it's incomplete. Get ready to party with the Lombardi, New Orleans. The miracle in Miami has happened. The Saints have won the Super Bowl.
The Saints have won the Super Bowl. They win the Lombardi Trophy, and the dancing continues in New Orleans, 31-17. It was the Saints' first Super Bowl win. Fire officials in Middletown, Connecticut, say they don't know if everyone's accounted for after a massive explosion at a power plant there yesterday. Rescue workers still can't explore an unstable portion of the unfinished building. The blast occurred as gas lines were being tested. It killed at least five workers.
Washington, D.C. is digging out from the snow following a weekend blizzard. Government offices are shut down due to hazardous travel conditions. Another 5 inches of snow could be on the way, and markets are up slightly. The Dow is trading at 10,012. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective.
Good morning, everyone. It may be buried by headlines about the Super Bowl and possibly Sarah Palin speaking over the weekend, but really the big thing going forward this week is the major military offensive in Afghanistan that is expected to take place any day now. The goal is to take the Taliban stronghold of Marja in the Helmand province. This will be the biggest offensive since President Obama announced his increase of 30,000 more troops to the war. Here is General Stanley McChrystal in Kabul yesterday.
All the planning for this operation has been led by the civilian side, with the military in support. And, of course, this is an Afghan-led operation. That's the thing that has been so impressive thus far.
Oh, what will we be thinking about the operation by the end of the week? Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, joins us in the studio. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And Rob Watson, political correspondent for our partner, the BBC, joins us from London. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning. You'll have to excuse me if I'm a bit slow because I stayed up to watch some of the Super Bowl, and as you can imagine with the time difference.
So did we all. And it's one of the few times that we actually are sympathetic about the time difference for
Coffee
you, Rob.
Provided today.
That's right, exactly. So let's talk about what's at stake here in Afghanistan. It's Afghan-led. Stanley McChrystal is actually announcing it in advance with the idea of kind of intimidating the Taliban. In terms of on the ground, do they need to take Marjan in the next couple of days for this to be effective?
I'm not sure that they need to take it in the next couple of days, but in many ways this is all about momentum and all about the new way of fighting in Afghanistan, the new way of trying to win this conflict. So it certainly has to be a success, and obviously to some extent the ground has been prepared, both here in the US, in the UK, where about 5,000 British troops will be involved, and in the US for the idea that there could be heavy casualties.
And Marcus Mabry, what do you think is at stake? And the president hasn't mentioned much about Afghanistan and this surge, and I'm wondering if that's deliberate.
Well, everything's at stake at this point. You know, the American public support for the war effort is waning greatly. One of the few, so we have to show market progress on the ground. Stan McChrystal has talked about some of that happening already. We have to do more if we're going to keep public support going. One of the merciful kind of things that the president's been spared with the victory of Scott Brown up in Massachusetts,
right,
taking his old seat, the kind of obsession right now with whether or not the Democrats can survive, can get their health care reform going, keeping on life support, our jobs, comes from the fact that now they're, Afghanistan's off the boiler for the president.
And what they're trying to get on the boiler or on the agenda this week, certainly congressional Democrats want a vote on a jobs bill today. Here's Harry Reid.
96% of the jobs created in the last 10 years have been by small businesses. So we're going to have to focus on letting more entrepreneurs do their thing.
Can the Democrats co-opt this entrepreneurs give money to small business message that's been so popular with Republicans and regain the high ground on jobs this week?
Well, it's kind of amazing. Democrats have to turn to jobs, of course. But it's kind of amazing that the Democrats are actually talking about things like small business right now and small business tax credits. Those are, you know, phrases you have not heard often put together in Democratic mouths. But the fact that Democrats have co-opted that central ground, that kind of moderate Republican ground, really, I think, shows how serious they are about, number one, getting something that politically is viable in Washington. It's going to be hard for the Republicans to say sit back with their hands folded on this, something that has both the phrase small business tax credits and the phrase jobs in it and not do anything.
But does it get Republican votes? That's the huge question.
That's exactly the question. It's hard to imagine, again, that some Republicans won't come on board. You know, in the Senate, again, the Republicans can stop every single legislative measure from happening if they want by threatening the filibuster. They could do that. It would be pretty unconscionable if they would do that in this regard. And if they do, then they're really overplaying their political hands, and the Democrats have an opening there to say, look, we're trying to do help small businesses. We're trying to do, give tax credits to small businesses. We're not looking to spend big government money. We're trying to help entrepreneurs.
At the risk of creating an international incident, Rob Watson?
Yes.
Do you know what an onside kick is? Can you explain that to me? You watched the Super Bowl last night, correct?
Yes, I did.
And?
And I've just been rewatching the highlights, I have to confess. An onside kick is when you take a short kick rather than punting it all the way down in the hope of turning over possession.
He did very well.
It's pronounced, John. It's the same thing in rugby, so maybe that's how
it is. Oh, nice, nice. All right, so how big of a deal is the Super Bowl in the UK, Rob Watson, aside from your own personal proclivities?
Well, to get into it, to make it a bit personal to start with, my neighbour in Oxford is from New Orleans, and so it's been very big. He's been telling me about it all, so I was kind of watching out of sympathy with him, so no doubt he's got a bit of a sore head this morning. But the BBC has taken over coverage of it here in the UK, so I guess I've got to wave the rattle for that. I think it is pretty big. You know, I'm sure a lot of people will have stayed up, and for most of the time we took the main US coverage, but we had a little pre-show of our own, and you know, I do think that if British people stay up in time to see that part of America, you just can't help but love it. I mean, the bit where the jets fly over just after the national anthem, as a longtime resident of the U.S., I just go weak at the knees for that stuff.
I love that. That's fantastic. And you know, I guess it also says that New Orleans really is an international city with an international sort of identity. Let's end the agenda with Sarah Palin speaking at the Tea Party convention in Nashville. Listen.
The Obama Pelosi Reid agenda. It's going to leave us less secure, more in debt, and more under the thumb of big government. And that is out of touch, and it's out of date. And if Scott Brown is any indication, it's running out of time.
All right, so the former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin is back. Did she and the National Tea Party convention in Nashville move the needle at all, and are they likely to move the needle this week?
They haven't moved the needle yet, but what's clear is if we look at the amount of media attention they got, this really relatively small gathering, it shows a kind of, you know, political mojo that's on their side. Certainly the media attention will continue to be focused on them.
And of course there was the inevitable question on Fox News. Here's Chris Wallace and Sarah Palin.
Why wouldn't you run for president?
I would. I would if I believe that that is the right thing to do for our country and for the Palin family. Certainly, I would do so.
Which is a harder question to answer, what's right for the country or what's right for the Palin family?
Well, you know, I think what's right for the Republican Party is the hardest thing to answer in this regard.
Good answer. Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, and an expat Super Bowl fan, Rob Watson, over there in London. Thanks, Rob.
If we look at the complicated issue of international adoption following last week's arrest of 10 Americans charged with attempting to kidnap 33 children from Haiti. And we're also asking you today a question about last night's Super Bowl. What did you take away from the game? Was it the rise of the Saints, the comeback of the Saints, maybe the what this means for the city of New Orleans? What did you take away from the game? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Election officials in Ukraine say they've now counted 93% of the votes cast in Sunday's presidential election. And opposition leader Viktor Yanukovych is still in the lead, but his margin is now less than 2.5%. His opponent, Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, is refusing to admit defeat and has appealed to her election team around the country to fight for every vote. Alexei Solohubenko joined us earlier. He's the head of the Europe region at the BBC World Service. With Yanukovych still in the lead, I asked him if the candidate is still projected to win.
I think probably yes. I think there were all sorts of things from Yulia Tymoshenko, all sorts of announcements and calls from Yulia Tymoshenko's headquarters. But it appears that the margin is sufficient enough to call it a valid election. And also various observers from the US, from the European Union, from Russia are saying that basically the polling went well and democratically. And therefore, I think it will be very difficult for her to challenge it, either through courts or through mass rallies.
Meaning that the result was reflected in the exit polls, which also showed Yanukovych walking away with the win. But could Tymoshenko stage a successful contesting of the election results?
I don't think at this stage this is possible, frankly. She would like to, but I think the overwhelming body of evidence coming from the electoral districts from across Ukraine is that actually the results are overwhelmingly in favor of Yanukovych. The margin, as you said, is very, very small, and the hope was on her side that if it is as small as it is, she would be able to reverse it. We're talking about 500,000, maybe 600,000 votes as the margin, but I think it will be very difficult for her to do it because of the overwhelming acceptance of the elections as democratic by various observers at this stage.
Well, Tymoshenko was a large figure in the protests known as the Orange Revolution about 5 years ago that put Ukraine onto a pro-Western slant. Is Yanukovych going to be moving the country in the other direction?
I think in some areas, yes. He already said that he will renegotiate the extension of the Russian Black Sea fleet stationing in Crimea, in Sevastopol. He also said he will look into the status of the Russian language in Ukraine and reverse some of the previous politics. I think he is very cold about NATO, and I don't think that either of the people engaged in this final round of presidential race were very, very keen on joining NATO. However, he wants to be part of the European Union. He understands that European Union is now the greatest trading partner with Ukraine. And therefore, yes, he will be friendly with Russia, more friendly than the previous president was. But I don't think he'll be a puppet. He won't be in cahoots with the Russian business, with Russian politicians. He'll be defending the interests of Ukraine, perhaps less vocally than the previous authorities.
Alexei Solohubenko is the head of the Europe region at the BBC World Service. He joined us earlier from Bush House to talk about the election results in Ukraine. At this point, 93% of votes have been counted. It looks like the opposition leader, Viktor Yanukovych, is in the lead and will probably walk away with the presidential win.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the complications of international adoption. There are fewer and fewer of those adoptions taking place, but they're more and more complicated than ever. That's after those 10 Americans were charged with attempting to kidnap 33 Haitian children. How typical of a story is that? We'll find out right after the headlines. And here's a check on leading stories. It's coming right up to 48 minutes after the hour. The latest on that explosion in Middletown, Connecticut. A Connecticut fire official says some people may still be trapped in the rubble. Deputy Fire Marshal Al Santostefano says because crews still haven't been able to search an unstable section of the plant.
Other agencies have brought in their search and rescue dogs. They're in the process of doing that right now, trying to get through the rubble up there.
Five people were dead, and the explosion could be heard 30 miles away. The Super Bowl was last night. The Saints beat the Colts 31-17. Damon Marbut, a restaurant manager in New Orleans, says it's a crazy atmosphere.
The entire city is just blown up, and I think my restaurant's destroyed. It's going to take my entire staff a good 2 hours to try to put it back together. It's absolutely wonderful.
The Super Bowl is a big entertainment night, big spectacle. It's also big business. Television advertisements during this year's Super Bowl reached some 100 million Americans. It's also a global phenomenon, though. Foreign businesses used the broadcast to advertise and then strengthen their brand. We were joined earlier by BBC's David Quinn from London. And I asked David, how big of a deal is the Super Bowl outside of the United States?
It's getting bigger and bigger, I would say, and its popularity continues to grow outside the US. And we are talking about very different markets such as Mexico, the UK, Australia, Japan. Many, many countries are now watching the Super Bowl and now following the NFL games. This year, for example, in London in October, we'll have another NFL game, the 49ers against the Denver Broncos in October, and that would be the 11th NFL game that is played in London and the third one of a regular season game. So you can imagine that it's getting bigger and bigger.
Do we have any evidence that the advertising during the Super Bowl actually works in other countries?
Well, you know, for example, I can tell you about the example of Mexico. In Mexico, what happens is that the advertisements that you see in the U.S. is not the same that it's broadcast in Mexico. But what you see there is that local advertisers, probably a global brand with a local touch, will use the Super Bowl to launch their own advertisement, but with the NFL logo. So it's, again, the same show business of advertisement, but with a local flavor and always using the NFL brand. So everybody feels that like they're watching the live ads on the Super Bowl.
Okay, David Quinn from the BBC talking about advertisements during the Super Bowl. Thanks so much. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Roll out of the shadows and find that eventually. There we are and what we are is still family.
This morning's family segment is motivated by the issues raised by the arrest of those 10 American Baptist church members and the 33 children they tried to take out of the earthquake-devastated nation of Haiti. In the world of international adoptions, the issues vary from nation to nation. Diplomats may be involved as much as social workers. Relations between the country of origin and the adoptive home may be as important as the family-to-family issues. And as parents learn, there is also a wide variance in the degree of candor about the circumstances of the adoptive children from country to country. David Smolin and his wife learned some of these lessons firsthand. David is a professor of law and a self-described inter-country adoption reformer. Good morning from Alabama, David.
Yes, morning.
Well, first of all, what are the unique perils and difficulties associated with country-to-country adoptions that you wouldn't find in a purely domestic adoption?
Well, I'd say it's that most inter-country adoption agencies in the U.S. don't really know that much about what goes on in the other country and don't take responsibility legally, ethically, for how the child is obtained and whether the child is a true orphan. There's a tendency to outsource all of the important work to a foreign orphanage or foreign just someone who comes to them or that they recruit and they pay to find children.
Right. Now, you know, many people in America who know anything at all about international adoptions may get their impression from listening to celebrities talk about their experience. Here's Brad Pitt.
You know, I look at my sons and my daughters, and one's from Vietnam and one's from Cambodia and one's from Ethiopia, and there's this kid who was born in Namibia. Each one of them offers so much to the mix.
We can only hope that Brad knows the actual names of the children in his own home. But, I mean, this celebrity idea that you can sort of pick and make a kind of, United Nations General Assembly around your breakfast table is really a misnomer and has nothing to do with what parents like yourselves went through.
Well, the problem is that there aren't as many orphans as people think there are. There are a lot of poor families who are willing to place children into some kind of place so they can get an education and that they can get room and board. But a lot of times those families do not intend to actually give up their children. But somewhere in this mix, children who are not true orphans end up getting placed into families here. And that's quite a tragedy.
What happened to you in 1998 when you adopted two girls from India? And congratulations for that, by the way.
Yeah. Well, what happened is that we went through a very well-accredited, very reputable agency here, and yet despite that, And despite trying to adopt older children for whom there's more of a need, we ended up tragically taking children away from a family who had a family. Their mom had been tricked into placing them somewhere just for room and board and for an education, when in fact the Indian orphanage intended to profit from placing them overseas.
Wow. So David Smolin, this idea of trafficking, which was raised by the Haitian church members, or the American church members who are trying to get kids out of Haiti, is actually something that people might encounter without knowing it.
Exactly. We've had trafficking scandals in China now, Guatemala, Nepal, India, Cambodia, Vietnam, Samoa. So it's become quite a common thing. And also we've had it in the past in Haiti as well.
So, David, what did you do when you discovered that there was a family back in India of your two daughters?
Well, we had to do it on our own, because even though we used a very reputable agency, they wouldn't help us figure it out. So we had older children, and they were coached to lie to us, tragically.
Oh.
And when the story emerged through their own friend, who'd been adopted into a different family here, they were pretty sure something was wrong, but they really didn't know, tragically, whether their mother had sold them or been tricked. And that just absolutely tortured them. The agency took the position that they did not need to know and that we did not need to know. So it took about 6 years to find somebody in India willing to go and try to find the rural village where our daughters said they were from. This had to be done gently, because we were told that if she had given them up voluntarily, the mom that is, that she could be harmed if someone went looking for her. So we had to find an appropriate person to do it, and because our agency, which is now a Hague-accredited agency, would not help us, we had to find our own way, which took a long time.
Well, and it's a heroic effort. You and your daughters are in contact now with their birth parents, and all through your own efforts, the institutions didn't help at all. And fortunately, you created a happy ending out of this, which should be a cautionary tale to anyone trying to do country-to-country adoptions. David Smolin, thanks so much for sharing that with us. David Smolin is a law professor and an intercountry adoption reformer who has two daughters adopted from India who, it turned out, were part of a trafficking effort. He attempted to rectify it on his own and made, as we said, heroic efforts there.
So we're asking you about last night's Super Bowl game in New Orleans. What did you take away from the game?
The game was great. Some of the commercials were a little lame, and I wish they would get some more entertainment at halftime. You know, lately all they've been doing is having those old-time rockers on there.
That's Walt from Detroit. What was
Janet
your take?
Jackson scared them.
That's
right.
Well, I don't think anyone cares if Pete Townsend opens his shirt. I think that's the thing. Give us your take. It's at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it on our website, thetakeaway.org. You can also go to thetakeaway.org or iTunes to subscribe to our podcast in case you want to rehear something or hear it for the first time. And here's your takeaway.
They haven't moved the needle yet, but what's clear is if we look at the amount of media attention that they got, this really relatively small gathering, it shows a kind of political mojo that's on their side. Certainly the media attention will continue to be focused on them.
That's Marcus Mabry with his analysis of the political mojo behind the Tea Party political movement.
I wonder if that's in the New York Times style book. Marcus Mabry, of course, with the New York Times political mojo as opposed to
significance. And how you can use it and the specific grammatical rules under which one uses mojo.
Marcus knows. He's a wordsmith, I have to say.
As always, we're taking your nominations for who has a good week and who has a bad week, which we will let you know who won on Friday. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is, so far, what would we say about this week? Bad week, I would say, so far.
Not if you're in New Orleans.
Not if you're in New Orleans. This is the takeaway. Toyota's nightmare movie, Total Recall.
Get ready for a surprise!
With an exploding PR problem and a new recall for the Prius Hybrid because of brake problems, the number one automaker suddenly has a global identity problem.
If I'm not me, who the hell am I?
Question from consumers. What did the secretive Toyota know, and when did they know it?
We hope you enjoyed the ride.
Toyota's decidedly bumpy ride. On the Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, February 8th, and the takeaway is sort of reconciling Toyota's corporate style with a sense that it's really keeping something from consumers on all these recall issues.
I think at this point it's really a handling problem for marketing while they take care of issues at the dealerships in terms of repairs. But let's get to the top stories in the news this morning, and the top story is parties in New Orleans. That's the sound of fans celebrating on New Orleans' famous Bourbon Street last night after their Saints' victory over the Colts in the Super Bowl. And this is the sound this morning of the Saints' victorious quarterback and MVP, Drew Brees.
I woke up this morning and immediately asked my wife if yesterday really happened or not.
It really happened, Drew. He was speaking on CBS's early show this morning. He went on to say that the Super Bowl was, for him, a dream come true.
In other news, troubles continue at Toyota. As we were talking about a moment ago, the company will recall its hybrid Prius models in Japan and may extend that recall to the U.S. 300,000 of those Priuses have been sold since May. And Toyota is certainly on the mind of Patty Bach. She's a real estate agent in Atlanta. Patty Bach, you own a 2007 Toyota Camry, right?
Yes.
And it's been recalled, right?
Yes, it has.
And do you get the feeling that the company knows a lot more about all this recall business than consumers like you?
I'm not sure. I think that perhaps people may just decide that there's something wrong with their car, too, just because they're hearing so much. There's so much going on.
So much media sort of coverage and hysteria.
Well, yes, I think so. And some of the hysteria is just on the part of the people.
Now, does Toyota still have you as a customer at this point?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I don't think there's a thing wrong with my car.
All right. Patty Bach, the Toyota company, is certainly betting there are a lot more people out there like you. Patty Bach, real estate agent from Atlanta, Georgia, and a Toyota owner. We're going to talk more about Toyota's troubles with Micheline Maynard of the New York Times in just a moment. It was all systems go this morning for the space shuttle Endeavour, launching in the pre-dawn hours from Cape Canaveral.
5, we have a code for ready to start. 2, 1... Booster ignition and liftoff of Shuttle Endeavour.
A final sight there. That's expected to be the last Endeavour launch or shuttle launch in the pre-dawn hours. It's crew of 6 carrying 2 of the last components to complete the International Space Station, including a dome-shaped module, which will give astronauts a panoramic view of space and the Earth below. Crews in Middletown, Connecticut have been spending the night going through debris at an unfinished power plant damaged by an explosion yesterday. Fire officials in Connecticut say at least 5 people died in the blast and around 12 people are injured. Terrorism has been ruled out in the investigation. Fire crews say it's still unclear whether anyone else is trapped in the rubble.
Looking at the markets, European markets rebounded today as investors looked past the slump in Asia. Dow Industrial's average futures were up 49 points, and Standard & Poor's 500 futures were up 3.5 points at 1,063. What would you take away from last night's Super Bowl?
You have to wonder, at a certain point, they're going to run out of heritage acts. The only thing I'm thinking right now is it's hard for a band to galvanize a crowd as diverse and big as a Super Bowl audience. Maybe since the White Stripes Seven Nation Army is such a big stadium hit, the White Stripes would be a pretty good bet for a future Super Bowl.
Karen Gantz from RollingStone.com commenting on, at some point we will lose all of our heritage rockers
go
one way
Janet
or the
Jackson,
other.
Go back to Janet Jackson, for heaven's sakes. That's all right. It's safe.
What do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. More about Toyota in just a minute.
Good morning, everyone. And we talked to that Toyota owner of a 2007 Camry there at the top of the hour. And you can hear in her voice a sense that she's sticking with the company. She's not worried. Her car has been recalled. Her Camry, one of the most popular models sold in America, is being recalled. But she's not going to worry about it. But here's Akio Toyoda, who's the CEO of Toyota, speaking in that celebrated apology that he gave at a news conference in Tokyo on Friday.
I'm trying to do this work as soon as possible and with cooperation of our employee and our supplier and the dealers.
So news over the weekend, the company announced it is going to recall its popular hybrid Prius model in Japan, and we're awaiting word as to whether that recall is going to be extended to the United States. Lots to talk about regarding Toyota. Here's Micheline Maynard. She covers the auto industry for our partner, the New York Times. She's author of The Selling of the American Economy, How Foreign Companies Are Remaking the American Dream. Mickey, good morning.
Good morning, John.
So I don't believe I've talked with you since this whole Toyota thing exploded. I mean, it really is a head-scratcher and one that I couldn't imagine we would have been talking about a year ago, right?
I don't think so. You know, Toyota's had quality problems before, specifically in 2005, when they had this unexpected spike in recalls. And at that time, the then CEO of Toyota issued an apology and put a committee together to make sure that it never happened again. And here we are 5 years later, and the same thing is happening again. And we wrote a piece on in the Times that ran this weekend that kind of looks at this pattern of discovering things, fixing them in the factories, but then being a little slow to recall the cars out on the road.
Well, let's take a look at some of that. I mean, in many ways, you're writing a portrait of a corporate culture that seems, on the one hand, careful if you're talking to shareholders, mm-hmm. but secretive if you're talking to consumers. Give us some examples.
Well, we were looking at a situation with these sticking pedals. There have been 2.3 million cars recalled in the United States because the accelerator pedal might stick. And I want to stress that, as people have been saying, there are very few cars involved in this. Out of 2.3 million, you know, there have been a couple of dozen reports of accidents, although when you look at the NHTSA database, the number of complaints is starting to grow.
Right.
But they had discovered a similar problem in around December 2008. In Ireland, I believe it was. By August of 2009, they were already replacing the pedals. They were the same pedals that are installed on some of the cars that are recalled in the United States. And yet, Toyota officials said they didn't know of any incidents in the United States until October, which was already after they discovered it in Europe and fixed it in Europe. And it just makes you wonder, do people really communicate inside Toyota?
And, you know, the remarks that they did make were less than honest. They must have known. And the pedals all came from the same outsource, a factory in Elkhart, Indiana, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, yeah, the company's based in Elkhart, Indiana. And honestly, the poor company, CTS, is getting blamed. And I think they would correctly say that, you know, we build what they ask us to build. They give us the idea and the outline, and we go ahead and build it. So essentially, there's, you know, one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing, or maybe they do, and they're hoping that it doesn't become a problem. I would hate to think that all the goodwill that Toyota has built up and all the good things that it's done, you know, for its workers and all that through the years would be wiped out by this whole situation.
Well, Mickey, listen to the voice of this woman. She's a Toyota Camry owner. Her car, Patty Bach's car, has been recalled. Here's this goodwill you were talking about.
I think that perhaps people may just decide that there's something wrong with their car, too, just because they're hearing so much. There's so much going on. And some of the hysteria is just on the part of the people.
So, Mickey Maynard, that's one consumer's view. It seems like Toyota can rely on her, but I'm wondering if other consumers might actually decide to, hey, you know what, maybe that thing that was going wrong with the car is a problem, and reporting is going to increase, and we're going to see more complaints.
Right, or people who noticed a little something in their cars and just, you know, wrote it down to road conditions or ice or something like that, or, gee, did that really happen?
Right.
It seemed kind of strange. Now they might go think back on it and file a complaint maybe with their dealer and with the federal government. But there can be kind of a hysteria about this thing, and, you know, people saying, oh, I'm afraid to drive the car. And somebody said to me, well, do you think anyone whose car has been recalled has been driving it since then? And I said, well, yeah, people have to get to work.
Right. You know, Toyota came into the U.S. market, you know, more than a generation ago. In that time, it has become the largest car maker in the world, surpassing its competitors, General Motors and Ford. Yet, I'm wondering, given the profit problems that Toyota's had over the last 18 months and this recall problem, have they learned some of the maybe negative lessons, wrong lessons about working in the U.S. market, betting on trucks, betting on high-profit big vehicles rather than focusing on what they did best?
My theory on this is not that it's the fault of anyone in the United States. I think the American executives correctly knew what this market was turning into, but everything at Toyota has to be cleared with executives in Japan, and the Japanese market is so much different than our market, and especially, it's, you know, it's like General Motors used to be, where people at Toyota look around and they only see people from Toyota, and they live in a Toyota world, and so they make decisions based on not the American market, but on what they see in Japan and what they think will be best for the company worldwide. So I would almost argue they were a little slow to do a competitive pickup truck, and they missed that market by a couple of years.
But they did create the Japan bubble. Does remind you of the old GM bubble from years ago. Do you think that Detroit automakers are in a position to take advantage of this vis-a-vis Toyota?
Well, the one bright note for Toyota, if it's a bright note at all, is that this is happening in one of the worst car markets in 25 years. So it's very possible that there might be some hoopla for the next couple of months, and then by spring, when sales pick up, it could overcome some of this. I don't think the Detroit companies are in much position to, you know, drive this home because they have relationships with Toyota. They have business relationships with them.
Finally, is this a technology story at all? The complexity of vehicles is getting to the point where we can't track safety the way we used to before we go?
Well, I think we get a lot more complaints about safety, but I was reading about computers on cars, and we had an excellent article on it in the Times last week. There are literally dozens and dozens of functions controlled by the computer, and if there's something going on with the software, it can be very, very difficult to fix that.
Maybe that's our next story. We'll ask you back. Senior business correspondent for the New York Times, Micheline Maynard, author of The Selling of the American Economy, How Foreign Companies Are Remaking the American Dream. Thanks, Mickey. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other stories we're following.
This morning saw the pre-dawn launch of the space shuttle Endeavour. The shuttle is now rocketing towards the International Space Station. It's carrying a brand new observation deck that will allow astronauts a panoramic view of space. And if you wondered what the link is between this story and another big story out this morning in the Super Bowl, just listen here to NASA launch manager Mike Moses.
We were loading our external tank, which is built in New Orleans, at the time the Super Bowl was going on. So while I was getting evil glares for having made them come in, I don't know why it was my fault, right, but made them come in for the Super Bowl, they were at least happy with the results of the game.
And in that game, just a reminder, the Saints overcame an early 10-point deficit to beat the Colts 31-17. Speaking after the game, Colts quarterback Peyton Manning said the win was well-deserved.
I give the Saints a lot of credit. They played well in all phases, made some critical plays on special teams. Drew did a good job getting his team in the end zone. They deserve to win.
Always a good guy in sports. That's
They're intergalactic favorites, including NASA.
Big parades planned in the Big Easy just days before Mardi Gras kicks off. Meanwhile, fire officials in Middletown, Connecticut say at least 95% of the workers who were at a power plant that exploded yesterday are accounted for. The blast, which occurred as gas lines were being tested, killed at least five people.
Snow day continues in the nation's capital after that horrible blizzard over the weekend. President Obama said Sunday he will convene a half-day bipartisan health care session at the White House to be televised live this month to try and break the political impasse on health care. And charges will be filed today against Michael Jackson's physician, Dr. Conrad Murray. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time to take some takeouts on the news, and we'll start with Todd Zwillick, our political correspondent in Washington. Todd, a weekend snowstorm meant that the federal government's closed down today. Schools are closed, but it also means that over the weekend, people were stuck at home, maybe with their TVs on, and they didn't miss Sarah Palin speaking at the Tea Party convention.
We need a commander-in-chief, not a professor of law standing at the lectern.
Todd, is Sarah Palin, she must be talking about the wars overseas.
Yeah, a big applause line. You hear the crowd erupt when she said that. A little bit of a coded message for the crowd at the Tea Party convention there. What she's talking about is the decision of the Obama administration to try some terror suspects in civilian courts, Article 3 courts, instead of treating them as prisoners of war or enemy combatants. This is a huge issue on the right, whether it's the Republican right or the independent Tea Party right that Sarah Palin is courting there. She knows this is a big issue for them.
Well, the White House, John Brennan actually came out over the weekend. He's the Deputy National Security Advisor, and he said, look, how come these things didn't bother you during the Bush administration? Here's what he had to say.
On Christmas night, I called a number of senior members of Congress. I explained to them that he was in FBI custody. None of those individuals raised any concerns with me at that point.
He's talking at Abdul Muttalib, the suspect arrested on Christmas for an attempted bombing of a plane over Detroit. But again, John Brennan is basically saying that you guys are turning terrorism and national security into a political landmine.
Well, yeah, and not during the Bush administration, of course. This is the Christmas attack that took place just this past Christmas. But he is saying exactly what you just said, Celeste, and it's very, very interesting because John Brennan is saying, hey, Republicans, you guys were briefed. You knew that he was read Miranda rights and being treated as a civilian prisoner at that time. You didn't say anything. Does this sound familiar at all? Because back in the spring, when the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, was criticizing Republicans for waterboarding and not telling anyone about it, they said, wait a second, Madam Speaker, you were briefed back in 2003. You didn't say anything. And then she said, well, I was briefed, but the CIA lied to me. This is the same exact scenario with the roles reversed. It's very interesting how Washington works in this way.
Okay, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
So one of the most momentous showdowns in Wall Street history, and you may not know anything about it, but Louise Story, our finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times, is writing about it. You actually call a showdown between AIG and Goldman Sachs over a lot of taxpayers' money, it turns out, as one of the biggest sort of behind-the-scenes, dramas in the whole financial meltdown. Explain.
That's right. So, you know, AIG was bailed out.
That's right.
You know they were bailed out because they were running out of cash, and so they needed a taxpayer bailout. But you might not fully understand why they needed mm-hmm. that money.
Well, they owed money to somebody, right?
To Goldman Sachs and other banks.
There we go.
But in addition to owing the money, they had already paid them billions of dollars. By the fall of 08, they already had paid out $30 billion to banks in these collateral calls. It's a technical word when you shift money over right. on assets that you've insured. And Goldman, for an entire year, had been at the forefront of demanding this money from AIG and also marking mortgage bonds kind of the lowest in the market. Now, that said, it was within Goldman's right to demand money if it really deserved the money. And the issue here is, was Goldman too aggressive or not? Were they right or not? Did they have motivations to push very hard for this money at a time that, you know, really the walls were just coming down on AIG?
Indeed. When did this showdown actually take place? Just remind us.
Yes, it started July 2007. That's when Goldman
wow.
first put in this demand. And it really got bigger and bigger. And, these are two companies that had been really close since the 90s. And they had once considered merging. And this tore apart this cozy relationship between AIG, Goldman Sachs. You had the chief executives at both companies at a very high level hashing this out. Mm. And in the end, you know, Goldman was paid. Goldman has survived very strong. And AIG fell and needed all this taxpayer money.
And AIG stock is nearly worthless. And Goldman got paid 100 cents to the dollar. In almost all cases.
They got paid out all of it, and they got paid out all of it by the taxpayer in the end.
Indeed. Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For our last takeout, we turn the mic over to you. On Friday, as libertarians and political independents met at the National Tea Party Convention in Nashville, we asked you what your new political party would look like if you could make one, and your answers ranged from very detailed platforms, actually, all the way down to sarcastic.
My friends and I, we've created a political party. We call it the Unawares Party. And like a scenario that you might find would be, you know, they'd ask us a question, and you'd lift your head up off the desk and say, huh, what was the question?
Oh, it's Charlie from Michigan. A lot of cynics from Michigan. Listen to Dan from West Bloomfield.
My new political party is the halftime or part-time party, since it appears that so many legislators have so much time to campaign. Legislation should be a part-time job. So I proposed on the platform to slash their salaries, and since they're part-time, they don't need vacation pay or free health care.
Okay, this is a very popular topic in Detroit. This is Walter from the Motor City.
I would have the American Non-Denominational Political Party. Currently, there's too much political paralysis in Washington and too much inactivity due to all this Republican versus Democratic thing. So my party would be for people who want to get together, work, and do something that's right for the country.
The non-party party, and he wasn't the only one, calling for sweeping goals to transcend political disputes and get something done.
The party that I would have would be the Transparency and Accountability Party, which would really push government leaders and politicians to be more transparent and accountable to its people, which is really what democracy is all about, and this is not occurring throughout the nation.
Other people dreamed of some crossover between the two parties that actually exist. Chris Orbach from Manhattan wrote to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. My party would be called the Libertarian Socialist Party. Fiscally conservative but socially liberal, defend both the rights of corporations and individuals. This would be something of a return to what pre-Culture War Republicanism used to be before the Bible-thumping anti-gay right to lifers hijacked it in a paranoid response to the late 60s counterculture.
Thank you, Chris. And for everyone who called in to 8778-MY-TAKE or posted their comments, as Chris did, on our website, thetakeaway.org. And you can see all the political parties our listeners want to create at thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, tough economic times mean states are slashing their budgets. Have some of them cut too deep? Coming up, in tough economic times, it just makes sense that you have to cut budgets. But is it possible you can cut too deep? We're going to talk about the state of Washington, where some people say they're removing essential educational services. First, though, here's a look at some of the news stories you're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Last night, Saints quarterback Drew Brees was the Super Bowl MVP, but it was this play by Tracy Porter that made New Orleans' dream come true.
Manning in the shotgun puts Polly in motion, looks in his direction, and it's picked off! It's Tracy Porter again! He's running free! He's going to go all the way! Hand outstretched! It is a safe touchdown! 70 yards on the return!
That 70-yard return made it a 31-17 victory for the Saints over the Colts. The Big Easy is celebrating their team success in style. Celestial stargazers saw the end of an era early this morning. The launch of the Space Shuttle Endeavour lit the night sky for miles around. It could be the last time that happens. All of the four remaining shuttle launches are scheduled for daylight hours.
Nearly all the workers at a power plant in Middletown, Connecticut are accounted for this morning after a big explosion at the plant yesterday that killed five. Councilwoman Hope Casper says the blast could be felt from miles around.
It felt like shaking. I mean, there was a loud noise. I don't think I've ever heard a noise that was that loud. And the windows in my house actually shook.
Rescuers are still checking one unstable area of the plant. Washington, D.C., digging out from that snow over the weekend. The weekend blizzard has shut government offices. And another 5 inches of snow could be on the way. In politics, Democrats will try to push a jobs bill through the Senate this week. Among other things, the bill would extend unemployment benefits. And looking at world markets, European markets rebounded a bit today. Asian markets continued to slide. Wall Street futures were up and down all morning, but the Dow opened down this morning. The Dow's down about 22 points right at the open. The S&P down a fraction and the NASDAQ down about a point and a half. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Maybe you've never heard the phrase funding cliff, but I guarantee your state senator knows it well. Sometime in the next year, the extra federal funds that have padded state budgets during the recession will run out. Tax revenues, though, have not rebounded yet, so state budgets are going to be teetering on the edge of a cliff. In some cases, they will be falling over. And lately, states have been making some deep cuts in order to balance their budgets. Sometimes, though, you can cut too deep. So deep that you're no longer providing the basic services that are guaranteed in your state constitution. And that brings us to the state of Washington. A judge there found the state was violating its constitution by not providing an ample education for all of its students. He's ordered the state legislature to fix it, and Tom Ahern is the lead attorney in that case. Tom, what did the judge find?
Well, the judge's ruling is based on Washington's constitution, and each state has a different education provision in their constitution, and ours says it's the paramount duty of the state to make ample provision for the education of all children residing within our borders. And the judge, after a trial that lasted from August through almost the end of October, found that the state simply was not doing that. The amount of funding the state was providing was grossly insufficient.
Let's go down to Daniel Thatcher. He's the education finance specialist for the National Conference of State Legislatures. Daniel, we have heard of these kind of lawsuits for years now, decades now, but there are certainly a number of them pending, and people are saying they might actually be successful now. Why is that?
Well, that's right. There's about 9 cases pending across the country right now. The success, I'm not sure about. I think it's too early to tell. What the success will be on these. There's 2 things at play here. There's traditional adequacy lawsuits, which is going on in Washington. And then there's other lawsuits, like there was one in Kansas, where they're actually challenging the funding of education because of the recession.
Well, a lot of people are talking about this funding cliff that I mentioned earlier. And Tom, let me ask you, people are saying that the funding cliff is the federal government funds, the extra funds, running out, state budget have not recovered in terms of income coming in faster, and therefore a lot of states are kind of teetering on the edge of not providing basic services like education, like policing and public safety. At what point does a state's constitution require that they not cut the budget too far?
Well, and that's exactly what the issue is going to come to a head here on. And there are times when the Constitution says you have to stop, you know, underspending. And we see that, for example, in take something like prison suits, when folks sue saying there's cruel and unusual punishment because your prisons are too small and you have too many people stuffed into a cell. Eventually, the courts say, you know, enough is enough is enough. You have to actually comply with your Constitution. And in, at least in the state of Washington, the court has made it very clear that their number one duty is to fully fund education before everything else.
Maybe that's the issue, though. Daniel Thatcher, let me get a comment from you, and we'll go back to Tom on this maybe. Sure. If we have time. Is this an argument, all taken together, looking at all the states, and they're all in different predicaments, for a complete rethinking of the strategy for funding education in the United States? It's been a state duty, property tax, then a lot of these lotteries have been funding education. But I'm wondering, especially if you see Barack Obama getting heavily into the mix with the stimulus program, that we're really looking at a federalized educational system in the United States 20 years from now.
Well, sure. They say never waste a crisis. And this could be a good time for states to rethink how they fund public education. Now, how they fund public education is different from how much they fund education. And, well, yes, the federal role in education is going to increase, and we're looking at perhaps an increase of 16% of total education revenues will come from the federal government by the time the federal stimulus dollars run out. And that's a huge increase. Typically, we run 8 to 9% of all revenues for education. It runs into 8 to 9%. So, whether or not the federal government will continue this role after the stimulus, I don't know if we can say that quite yet.
This is kind of the classic rock and hard place situation, though. What were you saying there, Tom?
Oh, I was just going to say, if I can jump in for a second, coming from the other Washington, I frankly don't want folks in Washington, D.C. governing the way my state's education system is run. Because one thing I learned very clearly, for example, in this lawsuit over the last 3 years we've been litigating this, is that people at the local level really do know how to do things best and really do know what their kids need, what their students need, how to make their schools work. So I although like most people, I'm sure I'd like to have money from wherever it comes from, I think it's a mistake to set education policy in the other Washington.
That's Tom Ahern, the lead attorney for the plaintiffs in this education funding lawsuit in Washington State. Daniel Thatcher of the National Conference of State Legislatures. We've been seeing state budget cuts on not just education, but on things, as I was saying, but police, roads, and in a certain extent, the states are stuck. They don't have a lot of money. But I'm wondering if there are other areas in which perhaps they're vulnerable to constitutional challenges.
There's three things really at play here. There is a decline in state revenues like we have not seen for a long time. There's a drying up of the stimulus funds, which after fiscal year 11, 12 will no longer be around. And one thing that we've had in the past recession is that local governments were able to step up and help fund education through levying higher property taxes. But this time around, with the deflated housing values, which lead to decreased valuations of homes, which in turn lead to lower property tax revenues, the local governments aren't going to be able to step up like they have in the past. So that's adding to this cliff. And whether or not state courts will look at how much a state is funding education in this whole context and say, you have to spend at this level, even though there's no revenues, either from the local governments, state governments, or federal governments. Again, I don't know how willing courts are going to be to say to states, you have to fund this education at this level, even though revenues aren't there.
That would kind of be a judge's ruling for an unfunded mandate, I guess. That's Daniel Thatcher, education finance specialist for the National Conference of State Legislatures, along with Tom Ahern, lead attorney for the plaintiffs in education funding lawsuit in Washington that was successful recently. Thanks to you both. Coming up, we're going to talk about the history of Black History Month and also its future. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And here's why I love New Orleans, Celeste. Anywhere else in the world, if you're partying and the sun comes up, you kind
of
go, oh, I've been up all night.
Gotta
in
get
New
a bed,
Orleans,
right?
In New Orleans, you go, the sun came up. I'm still partying. And your point is? And that's what they're doing in New Orleans. The Saints defeated the Indianapolis Colts yesterday in the Super Bowl, 31-17. Bright news for a place that has a habit culturally of turning bad news into great news, into joy. Jason Isaac joins us. He's a WNYC engineer and producer, one-time New Orleans resident who finds himself in New Orleans this morning. Jason, good morning.
Good morning. I don't know what happened. I thought I got on a plane to Indianapolis, and the next thing I knew, I was in the quarter.
Oh, boy. But, who are you going to pay for that mistake? You got to thank them.
Oh, yeah, you're right, John.
Describe the scene.
Great day to be in New Orleans.
Describe the scene.
Well, I was watching a game uptown last night, and at a bar, you know, neighborhood bar, long-time gathering spot for Saints fans, and it was absolutely raucous. The entire game, second half especially, starting with the onside kick to start the second half, the place just went crazy and then never settled down. By the time there was about a minute left in the game, people were standing on the bar. I saw a few men taking their shirts off, I guess for good luck or something.
For good luck, yeah, of course. It's for good luck, Jason. That's what they tell you down there in New Orleans. Hold on for 1 second. Jim Spalding, manager of the Avenue Pub down there in New Orleans. How many rounds were ordered just after that onside kick at the beginning of the second half, which really changed the momentum in favor of the Saints?
Wow, you can't count them. Too many to count.
So, you know, I don't want to count how much business you did last night, but are you still open, Jim?
Yeah, of course.
And how many people would you say are in the bar right now?
Maybe 90.
90?
That's just probably 80.
How have you managed to keep your voice?
I don't have a voice.
There we go. It's Jim Spalding, manager of the Avenue Pub in New Orleans. How much does this mean to the residents of New Orleans? And then we'll ask Jason before we go. Jim?
I've been here since 02.
And it means a lot. If you have to think about it that much, I suppose.
This was destiny, first off, to begin with. Katrina could have been the greatest catastrophe to ever happen. This is probably the greatest uncatastrophe.
Yeah, Jason Isaac, can you hear that? The coining
absolutely
of words, the fumbling for emotional descriptions. Take me there.
Well, listen, for 43 years, the city has had the absolute worst luck as far as football goes. And for a lot of that time, there's also been a steady drumbeat of bad news, with Louisiana ranking near the bottom in terms of education, economy, health care, things like that, among the 50 states. And for one night, New Orleans is number one, undisputed champions, and it means a whole lot to everyone here, without a doubt.
Indeed, and it's certainly going to give an extra joy to the Mardi Gras celebrations, which begin in less than a week. Jason Isaac, WNYC engineer and producer, one-time New Orleans resident, and Jim Spalding holding the fort down there at the Avenue Pub in New Orleans. Thanks and congratulations to both of you.
I'm Celeste Headlee, here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, if Black History Month was created in the 1920s as a temporary solution to the fact that most history textbooks included the accomplishments of white men, how come 80 or 90 years later we still have Black History Month? We're going to debate that in just a few minutes, but first here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. Space Shuttle Endeavour is set to arrive at the International Space Station on Wednesday with a new observation deck. Endeavour lit up the early morning sky in Florida as the spacecraft and its six astronauts rocketed into orbit. It's likely to be the last nighttime launch for the shuttle program. Rescuers in Middletown, Connecticut say at least five people are still unaccounted for after yesterday's explosion. Rescuers still haven't been able to search a section of the plant that's unstable. Five people have died in the blast.
Snow days continue in Washington, D.C. as forecasters still dig out from the blizzard over the weekend. Five more inches of snow are expected in the mid-Atlantic states. According to early results, Costa Rica has elected its first ever woman president, Laura Chinchilla. Her rivals have conceded victory and congratulated her, who is expected to continue the policies of the former president Nobel Peace Prize winner Oscar Arias. Vladimir Hernandez of the BBC's Spanish service has been following the story. We spoke with him a little earlier this morning. Costa Rica is a hugely influential nation throughout the region, I asked him, and how this election is going to ripple throughout South America, Central America.
Well, I mean, the fact that it's continuity in Costa Rica, as you've well said, that the country is always offering itself in negotiations, trying to bridge people together within the region, sort of maybe extreme postures on one side and the others, like recently happened in Honduras. Costa Rica was a main player in that situation, that crisis. And what appears to be is that this will continue. She is continuing the government of Oscar Arias, a well-respected figure in the whole region.
Can you give us a few facts about her as a politician and her background, Laura Chinchilla?
She is a political science. She used to be the vice president of the country. And the key issue here maybe is that she used to be the person in charge of security in Costa Rica. And this is one of the main concerns of the population right now, because as we all know, there is a high security alert in terms of drug-related violence in Central America and in Mexico particularly. So what she is expected to do in this case is quite significant, especially considering that Costa Rica doesn't have an army since about 50 years or so.
That report from Vladimir Hernandez, the BBC's Spanish service in London. Thanks so much.
It began in 1926 as Negro History Week. February was picked because it contains the birthdays of both Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. In 1976, it became Black History Month. And the goal, I'm going to quote directly here from the United States Department of State, is that one day the sharing and contribution of all Americans in America will be so appreciated, accepted, and understood that there will be no further need for any ethnic group to call attention to its contributions and exploits for the good of the country. Joining us now to talk about this is a William Payne, former assemblyman in the New Jersey State Legislature, author of a bill called the Amistad Law that enacted this type of education policy in New Jersey. And Raina Kelly's a staff writer for Newsweek magazine. She recently wrote an article on why she thinks we still need to keep Black History Month. Raina, let me start with you, because you went into this article expecting to talk about how you thought we shouldn't have Black History Month, and then you changed your mind.
That's exactly what happened. I was doing research on an essay that was going to be called The End of Black History Month. I think like a lot of people, a lot of African Americans, I found the month ghettoizing and patronizing. Why should our history be reduced to 1 month and, of course, the shortest month of the year?
Right.
And when I started doing research, I realized there was just so much I personally didn't understand about African American history, that what happened was I became disappointed with the way we've been celebrating Black History Month, not Black History Month. And I realize there's still a lot of work to do, there's still a lot of issues that we could bring to light.
But by continuing Black History Month, you might say that it allows us to be complacent about the inequality in our textbooks. In other words, we all teach about Thomas Edison, but the guy who invented the filament that goes inside the light bulb was an African-American, and that's not something that we have to learn about in February. And that brings us to Bill Payne. Bill, you actually were outraged by the inequality in the textbooks and in the history curriculum, and you set out in the 1990s to try and make it an everyday lesson, right, in New Jersey schools. And that led you to write this Amistad Law.
Absolutely, yes. It was my feeling that the contributions of African Americans to the development of this country, in fact, to the Western Hemisphere, should be taught to all students and throughout the year and in its proper chronology. For instance, I'm talking about the development of this country, for instance, when we had the Revolutionary War. We always taught about the Redcoats, taught about those who fought on our side, et cetera. But never do we teach in the general history about the role that African Americans played in the Revolutionary War. So many African American youngsters and white youngsters, for that matter, grow up with this sense that blacks simply did not exist, or if they were there, they were on the sidelines. And so, therefore, young African American youngsters growing up in this country don't see themselves in the textbooks, even throughout the Civil War, where we fought as well, but not taught that. So we grow up with a sense of low self-esteem, don't identify with the brave people in this country, because everything about African Americans is always negative, and that is during slavery we talk about pickaninnies, and then after that they talk about old Black Joe, but never do we talk about the positive things. So what Amistad does, it has U.S. history. We don't talk about Black history. We talk about the history of this country. And you simply cannot teach the history of this country if you leave out, omit the role that African Americans play, because in that sense, you're teaching lies, you're teaching myths, etc. So Amistad says you have to reconceptualize the teaching of history and social studies in this country, take it apart, put it back together again, and infuse the role that African Americans played throughout our history.
And Black you actually offer a free resources online for teachers. I want you both to listen to this clip from actor Morgan Freeman. This is back in 2005, and Raina's nodding her head. I'm sure she remembers this very well. This is Morgan Freeman on CBS's 60 Minutes.
I don't want a Black History Month. Black history is American history.
How are we going to get rid of racism?
Stop talking about it. I'm going to stop calling you a white man. And I'm going to ask you to stop calling me a Black man. I know you as Mike Wallace. You know me as Morgan Freeman. You want to say, well, I know this white guy named Mike Wallace. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh. Raina, I mean, you're very familiar with that. I'm very familiar with that. And it echoes this frustration that here is this temporary solution, which is what Black History Month was meant to be. And some people feel that because we still have Black History Month, it excuses people from not fixing the core problem of integrating the histories together.
I mean, I think that we both need Black History Month, and we need to recognize that Black History Month can make us complacent. I think I was talking to Annette Gordon-Reed, a historian who's done a lot of groundbreaking work on Thomas Jefferson, and she said, you know, Black history is American history. However, Black History Month is a time for a special appreciation. In a school curriculum right now, kids only go to school 180 days a year. There is not going to be time to pinpoint various issues like, you know,
There's huge dramas that remain to be told. You refer to the Hemingses, the Jefferson
exactly.
story. There's the slave revolt in 1712 in New York City, which was a huge event that nobody ever learns about.
You know, today is the 40th anniversary of the Orangeburg massacres in Mississippi. I mean, there are lots of stuff. There's lots of stuff that just can't be covered in a school year, but that we can draw special attention to in February.
Bill Payne, what do you think about that? There's not enough time in the rest of the year to call attention not just to African Americans, but to all minority contribution.
But I think we missed a point if we keep talking about Black history. I think what we're talking about is the history of the United States of America, U.S. history, and therefore which should be infused there, you see. Any kind, and I don't say let's get rid of Black history studies, but they're electives around the country. White children as well as African-American children must learn that a Black man invented the traffic light or the gas mask and things like that. So each group will have a feeling of self-esteem and say that I can do that as well. If we relegate it to Black History Week or Black History Month, you can rest assured that most schools throughout this country will not give serious attention to that. But if it's fact as part of the curriculum of U.S. history, every single school in the United States of America, regardless of whether there's any Black students or not, will have to teach this and will teach this. And those youngsters will benefit from it, white youngsters as well as the Black youngsters.
Bill Payne is a former assemblyman in the New Jersey State Legislature, author of the New Jersey Amistad Law, and Raina Kelly, staff writer for the Newsweek magazine. Thanks.
There was some history in that victory by the New Orleans Saints last night in the Super Bowl, 31-17. What did you take away from the Super Bowl victory? Is it symbolic triumph of New Orleans that's had so many troubles over the last few years, the emergence of a new football legend, or maybe some commercial you're going to be watching in a digital download all week? Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
As always, we want your nominations as well for who's having a good week and a bad week, so think about it this week and then call in your nominations at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post it to our website. We'll reveal the winners on Friday along with our friends at The Week magazine.
Yeah, we'll probably get Drew Brees good week, then Peyton Manning bad week. Okay, come on, you can do better than that. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.